United States versus Joel Eskenazi and others.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Marcus Funk on behalf of Appellant Joel Eskenazi. I'm here today with Michael Sink, an associate at my firm Perkins Coie, as well as Mike Rosen. What we're here to decide, what you're deciding here, is one of the most important compliance, corporate compliance issues of our time in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act context, which is, what does it mean to be an instrumentality of a foreign government? And if there's one thing that's clear, is that it is that the government's definition, and as I hope to persuade you, the government's definition of an instrumentality is exceptionally broad, and so broad as to be almost devoid of meaning. As the Carson Court said, the government has been sending mixed and conflicting signals as to who qualifies as an instrumentality. And as the court may well know, volumes have been written about this topic. Academics, former United States Attorney Generals, former prosecutors, in-house and outside counsel have all addressed this issue. And I think it's fair to say that all, or most if not all, have decided that the government's definition, which is extremely broad, is not accurate, not appropriate. And so before I, and just by way of clarification, Your Honors, I'm going to be talking about the jury instructions and the Brady issues per our October 2nd letter to the court, if that's acceptable. And then Mr. Rodriguez, counsel, will address the remaining issues. But a few words just about essentially the equities here. I think it's important for the court to understand the way Mr. Eskenazi was tried here. In this case, in Mr. Eskenazi's case, he being the CEO of Terra Communications, was portrayed as greedy. He was a greedy businessman who simply was a bad businessman and needed to make more money, wasn't able to make legitimate money, so he bribed employees of Haiti Teleco to try to basically get himself out of a financial hole. That's what was said in this trial. This is August of 2011. Fast forward 7 months to the Duperval trial. Duperval was the alleged recipient of the bribes. In the Duperval trial, and you can see it in the rebuttal, Mr. Duperval was characterized as an extortionist. He basically had Mr. Eskenazi over a gun, had all of Eskenazi's money, all of Eskenazi's investment, and if Eskenazi, and said, you know what, Mr. Eskenazi, we know you have legitimate contracts with us and we owe you money, but guess what, this is Haiti. What are you gonna do, sue us? It's not going to work. You're going to have to pay us if you want to get what you're already legally entitled to. And the term that the prosecution uses, that Duperval was the master, the art of the shakedown. I think it's just important for the court to understand that Mr. Eskenazi, who insists obviously on his innocence, but he was portrayed quite differently in these two different trials. And we'd submit that, frankly, the second trial comes a little closer to the truth, in the sense that he was very much a victim in this case.
Well, sometimes a shakedown and a bribe are two sides of the same coin.
And that certainly, Your Honor, that is a legitimate argument, and that's an argument that could have been made in terms of whether that qualifies, paying money in response to a shakedown, whether that qualifies as trying to retain business. But that's obviously not what happened here. And again, this is simply to try to put the optics of the case into a little bit more of an even field for the court. I think the jury instructions, I'll begin if it's acceptable to the court with the jury instructions. I'm very mindful of my limited 6 minutes I've got left, so I'm going to try to go through the jury instructions, because I think what the jury instructions do is they vividly illustrate the shortcomings of the government's position. But prior to getting into the jury instructions, I think it might be valuable to the court, I hope it's valuable to the court, to understand, essentially, you're being asked to decide what does instrumentality mean. And I think in this mountain of paper that you've gotten from both sides, there are basically three options before the court, three options for a definition of instrumentality. Option number one is the official part of the government test. Mr. Rodriguez and Mr. Rodriguez's counsel briefed that very heavily. That is the position they're taking, and that is that instrumentality must be read in line with agency, department, or foreign government. And therefore, in order to be an instrumentality, you have to be a formal official part of the government or a department or agency. State-owned enterprises can never be instrumentalities of a foreign government. That's option one, the official part of the government test. Option two is, if you will, and we adopt option one, obviously, but option two is, if you will, our Mr. Eskenazi's position, which is the traditional government functions test. Option two basically says, if a company is state-owned or state-controlled, and it conducts functions similar or akin to a formal government body, examples might be protecting military bases, providing police service, fire service, things like that, that will make you an instrumentality. In other words, state-owned enterprises can be instrumentalities of a foreign government under option two, but they have to perform the types of functions that a traditional government unit normally performs.
Generally or in the country at issue?
In the country at issue, Your Honor. In the country at issue. I think you have to, that as a matter of practicality, that has to be one of the considerations. I'm not going to say that's the only question. I think a test could be made where you look at essentially whether we view it as a traditional government function. But I think, in perfect example, Haiti, traditionally, telephone services were not provided by the government. They were provided by a private company. 1968 is when Haiti Telco was set up. So that brings us now to the third option. The third option is the government's option, which is the ownership and control test. And the government in the briefing said our the government's position is actually quite close to Mr. Eskenazi's position, is entirely different from Mr. Rodriguez's position. And I, as much as we're happy to get an endorsement from the government, at least a qualified one, I think there's a distinction that's important to be made. The government says, look, what you have to do is you have to own and you have to control the company, or control the company, plus you have to perform something more. The company has to, and the government in the briefing said, you have to sell commercial services. So if you're a company that's owned by the government, query, by the way, what does that mean, owned? 50%, 51%, 45%? But if you're owned by the government and you sell any commercial services, you're an instrumentality. Well, you have to be a very bad business person to not sell any commercial services or provide any commercial services or benefits to the people. So in other words, under that definition, once you're owned and controlled, I can't imagine, it's hard to imagine a company that would not qualify under that definition. So it's pure ownership or control gets you on the hook, if you will. The other option, I think it's important to note that when you look at these three options, we're talking about status versus function, right? Our option, option two, is about function. What does this company actually do? Option one is about the status of the company as a formal part of the government. Option three is about the status of the company as a state-owned or controlled entity. And to the extent that you think, well, you know, what is, you know, this lawyer standing before us here is saying this is what the government's position is, I'm sure the government will stand up and say that's incorrect. But let's have a look at the jury instructions that we objected to, but that the government tendered and the judge accepted in this case. And I think the jury instructions are exceptional, frankly. The jury instructions go arguably even beyond what the government wanted. What the jury instructions, and I really, this to me is the, actually probably the greatest flaw in this case, the most unfair thing are the jury instructions. I'm quoting, an instrumentality of a foreign government is a means, and then or an agency through which a function of the government is accomplished. I'm not quite sure what a means is, but if you perform a function of the government, for example, my law firm, when they withhold my taxes and give them to the government, that, I suppose, is a function of the government. They are helping the government. And then it goes on to say state-owned or state-controlled companies that provide services to the public may meet the definition. If you're a company that provides a service to the public, you are an instrumentality. And then you go on and they give a disjunctive list of the types of services and types of activities that might qualify you. And they say you provide services. So that's why I'm saying when the government says it's ownership or control plus some additional function, what they're really saying is not much, because the additional function is that they provide services, which, as I said, is essentially hard to imagine a company that doesn't provide some sort of services. It doesn't say services for the government or government-like services. It just says services.
But doesn't the word function get you to your second option, at least to some degree? something that was traditionally done by the government for its citizens?
I think it would if it said government function. But all it says is an agency through which a function of a foreign government is accomplished. It doesn't define, is it a traditional function? I guess to answer your question, Your Honor, our position is, and our position laid out in the extensive briefing is, it has to be a core function, if you will. It can't just be any function. It can't be a person sweeping the courthouse steps. It has to be someone who's actually doing something that traditionally is done in that country by the government. I see I only have 17 seconds left, but I have, I think, 5 minutes on Brady. Maybe if I can just continue with Brady, then...
You're out of time. Actually, see the red light blinking?
I do apologize, Your Honor.
But we'll hear from you again, and you'll
Thank
have
you very
full
much,
5 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Appreciate it.
Morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
I'm David Simon from Foley and Lardner, and I represent Carlos Rodriguez, the co-defendant in this case. With the court's indulgence, we've asked to split our part of the argument. I'm going to address the foreign official jury instruction issues under the FCPA, and my partner, Pam Johnston, is going to address some of the other issues on appeal. We agree with Mr. Esquenazi and his counsel that this jury instruction is the key issue in this case, and it's, in our view, clearly an error that justifies vacating or reversing the conviction of both defendants. Let me just say a few words about our position on what the jury instruction should be. We proposed a jury instruction at trial that said that to qualify as an instrumentality of a government, the entity, telco here, needed to be part of the government, a unit of government. And we think that's the right answer here. That should have been the instruction given to this jury. It's consistent with the intent of the statute. It's consistent with the structure of the statute. And it's frankly consistent with this court's holding, interpreting the term instrumentality.
What does that mean, unit of the government?
It's a part of the government. It's a unit of government, a part of a government, an agency of a government, something like...
Something that's owned by the government?
Ownership is not a unit of the government. No,
well,
it's an ownership is an asset of the government. It's not part of the government.
Well, if they control it and they charge fees for it and they get money for it, it seems like an asset. I mean, if it's a duck, it's a duck.
But that's the thing, Your Honor. It is an asset of the government. That's not the same thing as being a part of the government. Part of the government, a unit of government,
so
is an entity.
So national parks in this country are just merely an asset, not a function.
No, I think the national parks are a unit of the government in this country.
Why aren't they just considered an asset?
Because it's an entity created by statute. It's a part of the United States government. Anybody looking at it would know it's a part of the United States government. It's not a commercial entity that happens to be owned by the government. There's I think a pretty significant distinction between those two types of entities.
But in other countries, that distinction may be very blurry because a state-owned enterprise may be a commercial engine for the government in what is more likely a centralized economy. So what do you do in that circumstance?
You have to make a distinction in that circumstance between those entities that are part of the government, that are units of the government, and those that are simply owned by the government.
How do you make that distinction?
Well, you can tell if it's a part of the, I mean, telco is a great example. I mean, if I had to come up
you
with
You can tell it because you just know it.
I mean, you kind of just know it if it's part of the government.
You
know
it's a unit. You can't give a jury instruction that sounds like that.
Well, can you give a jury instruction, though, Your Honor, that requires the jury to sort through, you know, what percentage does the government own? When did it own it? What was the intent? Was it created by statute?
That's what juries do, isn't it? Go ahead.
No, I mean, my point is that even under your proposed reading of instrumentality, you'd have to delve into the structural niceties of a foreign government because every foreign government is different. They all run operations differently. They have different government units. They have different government enterprises. They have different democratic or partly democratic systems or autocratic systems. You'd have to delve into that no matter who's right on the instrumentality definition. You can't get away from it.
But our view is, and our position in this case is, it's much cleaner and much easier to tell in the government, out of the government, as opposed to...
You know, you've given me, or attempted to give me, that definition, what is in or out, and I've been practicing for 50 years, and I'm not sure your definition would make it with the jury, because I don't understand exactly how you're making those distinctions, other than you should feel it, and, you know, it's traditionally what governments do. Well, then we're back to the traditional United States definition.
Right. Well, I mean, a unit of government would be a municipality, a commission created by a statute, something that's set forth in the Constitution. Those are units of government. There, you can go to governmental constitutional documents or statutory documents and say, I see this. Here it is. It's, you know, the Department of Justice exists in a statute.
Of the foreign country, we go to their constitutional
documents?
Or do we go to the way that company or that country operates?
We would go to the constitution and statutes of that government.
Because a lot of countries have very nice constitutions that in no way follow them.
And your Honor, that highlights, I think, part of the problem with this case. I mean, this is a criminal case. People are in prison as a result of this prosecution, and you know, we don't normally do criminal law in a muddle like this, sorting through multi-factor tests with non-exhaustive, non-exclusive tests like the jury instruction test that was given in this case. To my mind, that invites a constitutional problem, because
under your definition, there would be a constitutional problem, because under your definition, as you keep explaining it, we look to a different host of things, and what you say, well, you can't do that in theirs because it's unconstitutional, but in mine, it would be unconstitutional also.
It's a much clearer, simpler, easier way to make that assessment. When you're asking things like, are they providing services for the people of the country? What does that mean?
How about a state-created corporation that is commercial in nature but acts to benefit the country as a whole?
Well,
the U.S. Olympic Committee, for example.
In our view, that would not qualify. It would have to be a unit of government where the government, the people are government employees. When the government shuts down, they're furloughed. You can tell. There's a difference, right? There could be. I mean, we know, for instance, the LeBron case.
A lot of these people are furloughed, aren't really doing a government function.
But they're part of a government. But they're part of the government. They get their paycheck from the government. They're part of the government pension plan. You look at their business card when you're dealing with them as a potential criminal defendant, and you can tell. Are they government or are they not?
Mr. Simon, the statute says department, agency, or instrumentality. You've given us several examples of what you say is an instrumentality. One of them is the Department of Justice. So it seems like to me, to define instrumentality, you keep coming back to department or agency. You've given us one example, a municipality, which is a separate government. So what's another example of an instrumentality that's not a department or an agency?
I mean, the FDIC, the central bank. This court dealt with this issue in the Edison case, albeit in a different statute, but interpreting the same term in the same structure. And the point there was, these are similar terms designed to be inclusive, examples, illustrations of what is a government. And when the court held that in Edison, That was the holding. So there are instrumentalities that are part of government that would fit. So it's not just a surplusage.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm addressing the money laundering and wire fraud issues, and of course invite any questions the court may have on that. With regard to those counts, we do believe that the court should reverse the money laundering counts and the wire fraud object of the conspiracy. In the concealment money laundering charges here, we need to see that there are actually proceeds from the specified unlawful activities. And because of the way the government charged the case, they charged it midstream. So in other words, the monies that are heading offshore to Haiti, they charge it in between step. And that's where they're saying those are the proceeds. But they're not proceeds yet because they haven't actually made it to Mr. Duperval in Haiti. We don't have proceeds until we have a completed crime. This is a very basic part of money laundering. It's a very simple problem. It could have been addressed and charged differently, and it wasn't. So in terms of the sufficiency of the evidence here, these money laundering counts don't fit the statute because they're not proceeds yet. With regard to the Haitian bribery predicate in the money laundering section, I guess they call it Article 137 in the Haiti statutes, is actually a misdemeanor. So the judge, when he didn't instruct and tell the jury that you have to use only a felony coming out of Haitian bribery law, failed to tell them this. And so the jury could easily have found that it was the conduct that was the 137. 137 is what criminalizes someone accepting a bribe. 140 is the one that criminalizes giving the bribe. Both were explained to the jury. Both went to the jury. Copy of the statute, both statutes go to the jury. So one's a felony, one's a misdemeanor, and the judge's failure to tell the jury that they needed to find only the felony for Haitian law was error.
Did he tell them that they had to find the misdemeanor? Or was the misdemeanor simply an explanation of the other side of the bribery coin?
It was more broad than that. It was that it could be a violation of Haitian bribery law could qualify as a predicate for the SUA.
So you're saying that the jury instruction fairly read allowed the jury to find either the misdemeanor violation or the felony violation as a predicate?
I do think that, yes. Yes, Your Honor, could be either.
And there was an objection on that ground to
no,
that
Your
instruction?
No, Your Honor, there was not. As the court knows, we're on plain error on this issue. With regard to the jury instruction on the Haitian law, we also have a problem there because we have a definition of public official, which is not clear and in such a way that it's actually, in some ways, it buttresses the other argument regarding the FCPA here. We've got two different definitions of public official in the case going to the jury. The one that goes to the jury on Haitian bribery law says it has to be appointed or elected post within a branch of the government, and it excludes employees of state-owned entities. So that doesn't fit with the facts here. This is a state-owned entity, as the court knows, this is our position. With regard to the wire fraud, the problem there was you have 83 overt acts in the indictment, so everyone knows what you're going to trial on. Some of those are wire transfers. The wire transfers turn out to be not proven to have left the state of Florida. They're all traveling around within the state of Florida, at least as to the proof that was established at trial. That's not a wire fraud. Wire fraud needs to cross state lines. It's an interstate wire communication, which is different than interstate commerce or the use of interstate commerce. And I think that's what got confused here, was merging those two ideas together. Obviously, under money laundering, interstate commerce is sufficient as the nexus for federal jurisdiction. But for wire fraud, it's got to be an actual crossing state lines wire. And that wasn't explained to the jury. But more importantly, that wasn't the evidence that came in. There's no proof of interstate wires that were the objects in the actual indictment.
Ms. Johnson, since we've given you all so much extra time, I'm going to try to hold you all. And you're out of time, and we appreciate hearing
from you.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Kirby Heller for the government. Let me start by talking about the instrumentality question and make clear what is the government's position. The government's position is that a state-owned enterprise may be an instrumentality under the FCPA. We have not adopted a categorical approach that the defendants attribute to the government. And in this case, the facts really almost overwhelmingly established that Teleco, in fact, was a foreign instrumentality.
If you had a one-sentence definition of instrumentality, what would it be?
Well, it would be an entity, I'll make it a long sentence, through which the government exercises its functions and has dominion and control over that entity. And that is what happened in this case. Teleco is 97% owned by the bank, by the government.
But your colleagues would argue, what's the government function, which is part of your one sentence?
Well, in this case, and I believe that it is providing phone service. It has a monopoly. Teleco has a monopoly. The government granted it a monopoly. And the fact that that's a commercial service doesn't mean it can't be an instrumentality of a government. And one way that we know that providing service can be a government function is by looking at the exception to the bribery prohibitions for routine governmental functions. The FCPA says that these are basically the grease payments. If that an official gets money for performing a routine governmental function, which the statute defines as including providing phone service, that turning on phone service, for example, that will not be subject to the prohibitions in the statute. So that shows that Congress certainly envisioned that that could be a governmental function. And again, I believe Judge Jordan asked the question, do we define it by the United States core functions or by other countries? And the defendants, at least Mr. Esquenazi, agrees it has to be by looking at other countries and how they define their functions. And in Haiti, they obviously define their functions by taking over this phone company, by having a monopoly, by controlling it through its board, through the people who direct it, by the fact that it has to pay for it, that any profits would go back to the government. It has to cover it when Teleco could not pay its bills, which happened here, all show that the government of Haiti sees this as a foreign instrumentality. The evidence, the instructions, rather, were consistent with that definition. The court started with it has to perform a function of this foreign government, and then it gave a series of permissive factors for the jury to consider, basically under a totality of the circumstances approach, which, as Judge Martin said, juries do all the time.
But usually not in the criminal law arena where notice is important. If you're letting juries figure out on a case-by-case basis what entity is an instrumentality and which one is not, you may at some point run into vagueness problems, no?
One may, and certainly not as applied to the facts of this case, and this would be a challenge, vagueness as applied. Here, the defendants, of course, were engaging in bribery, so already that's illegal conduct. And not only that, they were bribing officials who they knew worked for this nationalized phone company.
I know, but there's a fair amount of criminal conduct that isn't captured by the U.S. Code. Not every criminal act committed in the United States is a federal offense. And there are people who commit offenses every day who don't come under federal jurisdiction.
Right, but
so the fact that they committed a bribe doesn't necessarily mean that they knew that they were committing a federal offense.
Well, in this case, Your Honor, of course, they don't have to know that they're violating a specific.
I know, I meant
that
in the general sense.
That's true, Your Honor. In this case, though, these defendants have even come close to the line. In fact, vagueness doctrine and holding a statute void for vagueness, especially as applied, recognizes that there might be some difficulty at the margins. This case was not really at the margins because not only did they know who they were bribing and who they worked for, and that this was a nationalized government-owned company. Their own attorney characterized this in when he was trying to get insurance for their contract with Haiti, characterized it as an instrumentality of the government. These are people who do business with foreign countries all the time. They have a general counsel who advises them. They were not at all close to this perhaps difficult line, if it were difficult in this case.
Could you have the sort of control you're talking about with plurality ownership?
Well, certainly it would be a factor.
No. Could you have it?
Is
the control portion of your definition satisfied by plurality ownership? 40% and everybody else owes 10%.
And nothing else?
No, you've got the same facts as here.
Oh, possibly. I think we could defend, again, it's a fact question. If the jury found it, I think we could defend it.
Possibly is not a good answer.
I think we could defend it against a Rule 29 motion.
25% plurality ownership.
I think we could defend it if we had the same
15%
facts.
Plurality ownership.
Yes.
I'm going to take you all the way down to zero.
Well,
so
again, because it's
10%. 10%. I want to see how far the control principle goes.
Well, control.
Even though it may not be necessary here, we're writing an opinion one way or another that's going to control later cases. So we don't have the luxury of just saying we don't have to worry about a definition. So I want to know what control means for the United States government.
Well, control means more than ownership, and that's why obviously I'm having trouble
the control part.
Well, control, again, is who runs it, who appoints the people who run it, how the money is controlled, what happens to the money. All of that goes to it. So it's not, I don't believe it's simply an ownership factor. So one of the perhaps what I would say is absurd examples that are in the defendant's briefs are General Motors. For a very short period of time, the government owned a majority of the shares of General Motors. We would not say that that's an instrumentality of the government because you would look at these other factors. How long did the government own it? Did it control it? Did it control its board? Did it compete in the marketplace? These are all factors that go to the instrumentality issue, and that's why it's a jury question.
So you've got to look at how long the government was in a market?
That would be
you just don't take a slice of time and judge it based on what was happening at a given point in time?
I think the permanence or temporary nature of the ownership would be a
So if factor. This if this if Mr. Eskenazi and Mr. Rodriguez had acted a week after the government created the monopoly and acquired 97% ownership, would they come within the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act?
I think that would be difficult for the government to prove because we wouldn't have any knowledge of the rest of the package that went with Haiti
sure.
owning
them. Sure, they
owned it.
Everything else remains the same, except there's a temporal difference. Now what?
I believe we could defend that on a Rule 29 motion.
The problem is not whether you could defend it. The problem is whether you would charge it.
Well, that's certainly, the government would certainly exercise its discretion wisely, and I can't answer whether we would charge that particular fact pattern. Again, that's not.
But you see, if you say you could defend that, then your answer to the General Motors hypothetical isn't that persuasive.
Well, again,
because if you say that the reason you wouldn't prosecute the General Motors scenario is because it was temporary, and the government wasn't a player in the marketplace, and you knew it was ephemeral, and the government was going to get out. What about the situation where the government barely gets in, and then there's a bribe?
But again, if we have all the other factors, if we know by the time the government gets in that it looks like it's going to stay in, it's not just bailing it out temporarily, if it controls, again, the board, the people who run it, if it says we're taking all the profits and we're going to cover your losses, if it has all those factors, then yes, I believe it would fall under the statute. Now, another factor that I think is important in understanding what Congress intended, of course, and what the purpose of the statute is to look at what happened in 1998. There was a treaty that the government ratified that with other countries pursuant to this Convention Against Foreign bribery by the Organization of Economic and Cooperation Development, which, as I said, the United States was a party to that. Senate ratified it and required the parties to pass statutes that made foreign bribery a crime. And of course, we had a statute, but Congress made some amended it to compensate for one aspect of the foreign official definition that was in the convention that wasn't in the FCPA, but it didn't change anything else. And certainly that would, and I should mention the other important fact is the convention clearly prohibits payments to what is the equivalent of an organization like Teleco. It's, you know, what it says something like an entity, whatever its legal status, that is controlled and the foreign government has dominion over, and then it lists a series of factors that are similar to the factors here. By signing on to the treaty and then by passing, by amending the statute to conform to it, I think it's clear evidence, and perhaps maybe the most persuasive evidence, that this statute was meant to apply to officials of entities like Teleco. If there are no other questions on the instrumentality question, let me briefly address the other questions. I would like just add one other point about the instrumentality, and that is because Mr. Rodriguez has somewhat of a different take than Mr. Esquenazi, and that is he, relying on this court's decision in Edison, he wants to say that it has to be an actual entity that is created by the state. And not only, of course, was Edison applied in a completely different context, but it also was talking about a private company that had the contract with the state. And it relied, in turn, on a Second Circuit decision in Green. And there, the Court of Appeals, the Second Circuit, said, we want to look to see whether it is created by the state or whether it belongs to the state. And that, again, takes us back to our definition here, that you want to look at whether, by looking at these factors, it somehow belongs to the state. Briefly going to the money laundering and wire fraud objects, wire fraud and foreign bribery objects. First of all, as Ms. Johnson recognizes, this is on plain error review. We also believe that's a legal question. If the defendants had come to the judge and said, the foreign bribery isn't an appropriate predicate because it's not a felony, the judge would have decided. The jury isn't in a position to decide what's a felony and what's not. In any case, our expert testified that one of the provisions of Haitian law was a felony, so it certainly would qualify, and there'd be no plain error as to that. In terms of the wire fraud object, the government wasn't required to prove that any wire moved, there was any interstate or foreign wire. This is a conspiracy, after all. It just, the defendants have to be, it has to be reasonably foreseeable to the defendants. Certainly, this is a case involving bribes between Florida businessmen and Haitian officials. Defendants could reasonably foresee that there would be interstate and foreign wires, and there were. There were plenty. There were foreign faxes. There were emails between the officials in Haiti and the officials in Florida. So there's really no question, again, certainly under plain error review, but under any review, that this was an appropriate predicate. Unless the court has any other questions,
okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your Honors, it's this discussion we're having, which I think just highlights why we decided to take this case pro bono and why this prosecution of Mr. Esquenazi, who's serving a record-setting 15 years in jail for the conviction in this case is unfair. There is, I agree with the government, there is absurdity in the General Motors example. The absurdity that's in the General Motors example is that, in fact, when you look at the jury instruction, General Motors would qualify. It is a government-owned or controlled, again, whatever those two terms mean, business that provides services. Not core government services, not services that the government performs, just services. It cannot be, and this is, I may be overstating it to say it's a thought experiment, because it doesn't require a ton of thought, frankly. As your honors look at this, and you pull out that jury instruction, I believe it's on page 23 or so of the tendered instructions, imagine to yourself, setting aside that it is, who knows what government controlled means, who knows, to Judge Jordan's point, what government owned or controlled is, ask yourself, let's just assume for the purpose of argument, you've got a government-controlled or government-owned business. Look at those jury instructions and imagine a company that would not qualify. And that is the fundamental, one of the fundamental flaws in that jury instructions. The court asks, give me an example of what a jury, what a government entity, an instrumentality would be. And the government said, an entity through which the government exercises its functions and has dominion or control. That's nice. It doesn't go far enough in our opinion. It should be core functions, but that is not what the jury instruction said. You cannot put those two statements together and reconcile them. I'll tell you that right now, and I'm sure you'll take me up on the invitation to engage in this thought experiment, because it simply is not. But I digress. I have two minutes. I want to make sure I talk about Brady. The Brady issue here, you've all been prosecutors. The jury comes back with a verdict on August the 4th of 2011. On the 10th, the defense attorneys get a letter. And remember, the key thing in this trial was, what is a government instrumentality? The government, the government had a witness. And he said, well, one of the important things, actually, in fact, the government mentioned this as a key factor, is whether board members are appointed. Board officials are appointed by the government. And when pressed on cross, Mr. Lasad, the government expert, said, well, you know, the bylaws would dictate that. I don't have them. I'm not sure, but I'm assuming that the bylaws of Haiti Telco were amended to formally allow the government to make these appointments. In other words, turning it from an SA to an SAM. August 10th comes along, we get a letter from the prime minister, tendered by the government of Haiti, saying Haiti is not, and essentially has never been, a state enterprise. Boy, that's pretty good information for us. Wish you would have had that on the 3rd, the 4th, the 2nd, any other time.
I have a question about this, and I'll speak quickly, because I know you're worried about your time. Brady is evidence favorable to the defense.
Correct.
Not in the defense possession and not capable of being obtained with reasonable diligence. But it was one of the co-defendants that got that information. So how do you meet that prong?
That's true, Your Honor. I think the way we meet that prong is the follow-up letter on the 25th of August that said, oh, whoops, my bad. I'm the prime minister. I made a mistake. The American government helped me rewrite my letter. And now I'm going to say it is not, it's always been a state enterprise. And the problem is we had no information that the bylaws had been changed, that the Haiti bylaws had been changed. In fact, the government's expert claimed to have no information about that. Well, now we know from the prime minister that they had been changed. The prime minister knew. And, you know, having spent some time at the State Department myself, I know and you know, we have a government prosecution team here. We have the government of Haiti there. This critical information somehow made its way through however many steps from the government of Haiti to the prosecutors.
But the declaration came after the verdict, right?
The declaration came after the verdict, but the question is the information in the declaration.
So how could it have been suppressed by the government? That's what you're saying, the information.
Suppressed means simply not tendered. We have no evidence, and we have a right to know, whether government officials, our government officials in Haiti, knew about this change in the bylaws. Everything about the letter, everything anything about the circumstances of how these letters were exchanged gives us at least circumstantial evidence to indicate that the government officials, our government officials, knew or may have known or should have known through due diligence the answer to that question. But for whatever reason, the government didn't want to provide affidavit, didn't want to provide a hearing, didn't want to answer the question. I see my time is up, Your Honor.
Thank you.
That Mr. Eskenazi's conviction be vacated.
Thank you.
I'd just like to return briefly to the instrumentality question again. I thought the government's inability or unwillingness to draw a clear line in response to the court's question really was revealing of the problem with the jury instruction in this case. We should have a bright line in a criminal case. And the inability to do that, the difficulty struggling with lots of smart lawyers researching this issue extensively, the trouble we're having figuring this out suggests a problem in the instruction that is frankly, interpreted the government's way, we think, vague. The other point I just wanted to address briefly was the government's statement that telco's not on the margins here, that it's so obviously government that we don't need to worry about the niceties of the jury instruction. I mean, telco's actually, the facts of this case are very confusing and very, very difficult to sort out. Telco started as a private company, wasn't created by statute, wasn't created by the Constitution. It, according to their expert, the government's expert, Mr. Lassad, we don't really know how the government came to own it, but it appears as though maybe they had a debt to the government and they couldn't pay the debt, so the government stepped in as a creditor, not as government acting as providing a service, but the Bank of Haiti, government acting as a creditor, not as government qua government. That's significant. We, of course, have the Bellerive Declaration, where we have the Prime Minister of Haiti on the one hand saying it is a state entity, on the other hand saying it's not. I mean, the level of confusion around this issue, when you're talking about a criminal case, when you're talking about prosecuting someone for violating the FCPA, should give us all pause. And the fact that we can't be clear about what is and what is not criminal under the district court's instruction is grounds for reversal. So we would ask, we join the argument on Brady as well, which we briefed.
Is your argument now that the statute itself is vague?
No.
It's a constitutional argument?
No, Your Honor. Our position is you have two ways of interpreting instrumentality. One way would create a vagueness problem. Our way wouldn't. And so you should choose the way that doesn't create the constitutional
and
problem.
Your way is the way you attempted to describe it.
A unit of the government, as this court held in Edison.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is that it? Are you all, you're done? Okay, I wasn't sure. Thank you very much. We appreciate the presentation. It was helpful to our consideration of the case. So you are excused, and we'll get ready for our next case. Sorry, I thought Ms. Johnson was going to get